Accession number 18463, reel 41.
Section to reform of the platoon again. This again, they were, everybody was pleased that the platoon was reformed again, but unfortunately they weren't too happy that this sergeant had been brought in, and that again has surprised me, because I mean I thought that they'd be pleased to see the back of me, because I did sort of keep them on a fairly tight rein. Anyway, when we got back up the line, we were only there 12 days before, of course, before we were relieved. And I think I said before that some of them, well, they literally wouldn't take orders from him. And, you know, the new boys were okay, and he got them around in quite a large platoon HQ, larger than we'd ever had for a long time. And in the end, he said to me, well, look, I'll pass my orders through you, and if they disobeyed, I'll just charge them. Well, we didn't want that in the last day, so he'd come along and tell me what he wanted done, and I'd sort of tell the lads what to do, which wasn't a very comfortable way of going on. But as I say, we were nearing the end of our tour, so it worked reasonably well. But unfortunately, of course, Major Allen wasn't too pleased that he'd been sent up, apparently. I mean, he never said, you never knew what he was thinking. But on the mornings, when he came round each morning, he'd, poor old platoon commander, would be tottering on behind, trying to please him, and he'd come up and have a long chat with me and talk about the Nakdong and things like that. And it was obvious to anybody listening that he wasn't happy at having a sergeant sort of pushed onto him, because he was a fairly strong character. In fact, he became second in command of the battalion, and then, of course, a colonel in his own, a lieutenant colonel in his own right. I think he died about age 70 or something like that, out sailing, or as I'm told, and he had a little market garden and things like that. I liked him very, very much. I could work with him. I understood him. He never gave any praise, and he was very, very quick to be critical of anything that you did. But you knew where you stood with him, you know. I trusted him, and I think that's perhaps one of the most important things in any operation that you're engaged in. That's it, I think, on that bit.
Why were 45 so much desired?
Aha! Well, everybody wanted a 45 automatic, American automatic. All the officers change their 38s for 45s. Well, 45 is a man stopper, of course, you know, half inch bullet goes into you, you don't get up and walk away again, so that's one of the things. Automatics were much sought after. Chris Lawrence had two. He had one on his belt and another one in a shoulder holster underneath his clothing, so he was going to go, he was going to fight to the last, we always thought. One of the problems, of course, in Korea was that the Chinese were anxious to capture anybody with a pistol. They had to be an officer, or, you know, a revolver or a pistol or whatever they had. And I'm told, the 29 Brigade told me that they used to try and pull the officers off the vehicles and tanks and things like that. But everybody wanted a 45, you know, and I remember when we saw, we passed some rocks once, and this chap had a pearl-handled 45 at his belt. They always had fairly ostentatious equipment, the officers. And everybody was going, have a look at that then. If he goes down, we'll have his pistol. And we also saw an American once on the Nakdong. He had two, one on each side, 45s. And there was shelling. We were walking through this shelling that was going on, and everybody was watching him as they went by to see if he got hit, and then he dashed out and nipped it. And the guy, the MO that got killed up at by the sniper when he was going, the MO going up to help Chris Lawrence's wounded on Plum Pudding, Ken Partridge, my friend, said, I'm going to crawl down there and get his 45 during the night. And I stopped him because, I mean, someone would have shot him accidentally. And then we all watched as the chap found the 45, his 45 was out and underneath him. Everybody wanted a 45 automatic. When I got mine, I was as proud as punch, walking about there, strutting about with it hanging. And when the company commander said, Mr. Brown's pistol, I'll have that, I've lost mine. I thought, oh, God. Why didn't I hide it in my belt or somewhere like that? Everybody wanted a 45 automatic. Only a toy. I mean, it's just a, I guess it's the old cowboy and Indian, no, well, not Indian bit, isn't it, really? An old police man's bit. You want an automatic pistol. We had a Canadian once who came up to us and said he got a 38 and he only got one round at it. And I thought that must be old Rex Kane's pistol because he only had the single round, you know, and one revolver and one single round. And he was trying to beg 38 rounds from the platoon commander who didn't have any to spare. I didn't know at that time, because you can fire a 9mm through a 38. 9mm is rimless, and 38 is got a rim on it, but if you nick the rim so they don't fall out, and you can fire them single round anyway, 9mm, 38, it's both the same size, so you could fire them. But I didn't know that at the time, whether we would have given him a few 9mm rounds and he could have banged those in there. No, just a toy, really. Nobody really, very rare anybody gets, people get murdered with pistols, but not too many people get killed by them. But then, there's lots of things like that.
How do you feel now in 1998 about having served in the Korean War?
I wouldn't have missed it for the world. I wouldn't have missed it for the world. Silly, isn't it, really? It's a terrible thing to say, really, because... and I'm sure any young person who might one day listen to this tape, if they ever do, would think, what a funny old chap that is, you know. But I wouldn't have missed it. And I mean, I've heard people at the reunions where we go, because our Korean club is a very rare one because it's mainly national servicemen there. We've got some regulars now, and lots of the national servicemen, of course, are dying off. But the CO is always telling us that we're a rarity to have an association of national servicemen. And they're all the same. And I remember, I think it was the Falklands or something like that, where a reunion came up about that time. And all these silly old so-and-sos were saying to the CO, who must have been about 80, 90 now, I think, about 80 or 70 or 80 at that time, was saying to him, come on, sir, we could charge up that beach, we could do it all. And he was saying, don't be silly old sausages, you know, you can't do that. But it just sort of, I guess it's just pride in the thing. 27 Brigade is to us was our life. We had absolute confidence in Brigadier Code, absolute confidence in Mickey Mann, and the company commanders. I mean, they came and went. Unfortunately, because as they go, then certain amount of confidence does wane a little bit, you know. And then, of course, when poor old Rowley Gwynn was sent packing and this new CO came along, and we didn't have the same confidence in him as we didn't, of course, with the new brigadier. Very unfair, but that's just people, isn't it? You know, it's just the way you feel at the time. I guess that's sort of way life goes on. You have confidence in the people you know, and you don't have so much confidence in the ones you don't know. And occasionally, all new people fail in some form or other, and we've only got to go through our list of platoon commanders to see that some didn't quite make the grade. They weren't quite up to it, and there's nothing wrong in that. I mean, they just can't. They don't know what to do. It's like the last one that was, well, not the last one, the last officer that was wounded. The time came in the emergency, and he didn't know quite what to do about it. So he did what we all do. He did the thing he did know something about. He took the LMG away from the chap who was just clearing a stoppage and would have got it going in a few seconds, and started to try and clear this stoppage. So you had him clearing a stoppage on an LMG, which he knew he could do, the platoon milling about there, looking to him to find out what his orders were, and the poor old lad with the LMG completely unarmed. It's not unusual. It's like a car breaks down. You don't know anything about cars, do you? But you do the simple things. You look at the water and the petrol and things like that. But, of course, that isn't quite what you need in an emergency. You need somebody to act fairly, even to get it wrong. Getting it wrong's okay as long as you're doing something and getting people moving and into some sort of position. That's life, I guess.
Did the political aspect of the war mean anything to you?
Not at all. Not at all. Didn't mean anything to me, and it wouldn't have meant anything. We were in a capsule, I guess you might say, of 27 Brigade. We weren't fighting the United Nations or American 8th Army or I mean, they'd said to us before we went, you've got the traditions and history of the British Army to keep up. And that's all we were. We were just 27 Brigade. We didn't think highly of anybody else. I think we'd have preferred to have been all brigaded together, so that 29 Brigade and 27 and then maybe the Australians, well, it would have been the Australians, and we could have, when the division was formed, I'm sure there was a different attitude. But 27 Brigade was the most, well, was the only important thing to us. Brigadier Coe was the, you know, we had absolute trust in him, which is why now that people are trying to knock him and tell lies about him, some of us are feeling just a little bit miffed and fighting on his behalf now he's dead. But I must say, when he went, it was a very sad day. I mean, we didn't know what was going to happen to us from then on. And of course, when the colonel went, collapsed as well. And then Rowley Grimm was pushed out of things. Not good for morale, that. Very bad for morale, that. It's a wonder. I always think it's a wonderful thing that after the brigadier and the CO went, the battalion still went on operating as usual. And despite the disparaging remarks from in certain histories, which say that on the Fish Hills, for example, that we wouldn't, we were reluctant to fight, it's quite wrong. It's absolutely wrong, completely. It is true that we failed to take one small hill, but that was because we were the company that was doing it, C Company, was shelled by the medium guns and they withdrew. I mean, they'd lost two platoon commanders and they withdrew. We were expecting, B Company were expecting to pass through and do it again, but the brigadier decided to push the Australians through. A complete battalion went through where we'd had a company trying to attack before. But it's very untrue. I've seen one or two little things like that. In the official history, the General Farrar Huckley, and I'm surprised at this because being so knowledgeable in Chinese tactics and having been a prisoner, he disputes that there were, he says that there couldn't possibly have been any Chinese in the retreating rocks, six rocks at Cap Yong. And he's absolutely right, there couldn't have been because they'd have seen them straight away. But what there were in them, and I'm absolutely convinced of this, is there were these Korean irregulars. And everybody knows that Chinese divisions had North Korean irregulars who acted as a screening force around them. It was them who were in the column, and we knew they were in the column, and it was them who attacked us and caused their casualties. North Korean irregulars. But he missed that point. In fact, I did mention this to him, and I think he took it on board, but it's a bit late now to change the history. I was a bit surprised that he hadn't really tumbled to that. All histories, of course, have faults in them, don't they? I mean, he has one or two glaring little faults, but I don't think they're his faults. I think what happened was that he took the word of, probably of some of our more senior officers, he took their word of certain actions, and they just got it wrong, you know. All the casualties at Middlesex Hill are attributed to D Company, which of course is completely wrong.
You mean things which the private soldier might have corrected?
Well, could have done if he'd been asked, yeah. One of the problems in life is that if you're a colonel, everything you say is correct. Can't be anything wrong. It's taken. But if Private Barrett says, this is not right, no one will listen to you. And I still got problems, which I'm working on the NACTON now, on the positions of companies. Not important, but they're important to me, but I know I'm right. And the official history has got it wrong in a broad sense. And I found a map in the PRO that I believe was marked up in Barrow long, long after the event by somebody or other. And it's wrong. As far as I'm concerned, it's wrong. If I could walk that road, I would know it instantly. But I have to rely on papers. And some of the papers are wrong that are written. See, we've got a little bit of a difficulty on the NACTON is that the intelligence officer who was supposedly looking after the dispositions and of the companies and things like that on behalf of the CO and through the CO, he was from about the 8th of September when his batman was killed until he vanished. Was not in the best of health, and it's obvious. I've got some papers, and they're not signed by him, and they're in two different hands, and I should think they were his intelligence section were writing these out, and some of them are, well, they're absolutely wrong, completely and utterly wrong. I could show you on the map where they're wrong, you know, positions shown completely wrong. I can work them back and get the right, what I believe to be the right map reference, but you know, because it's so long, you can never know. But that's virtually how I believe the official historian, he read these, which he would have been privy to, whilst I get him through the back door, and I think that's how he got that wrong. In the same way, he says that we marched up to Middlesex Hill and didn't. Nothing, there was no shellfire at all. Of course, there was shellfire, came right down on us, and we kept marching because we've been told not to stop for the shellfire, so we kept marching on and on and on. And in the end, I got a feeling it was John Shipster's voice, but it might not have been. It's somebody's voice shouted out, "Get down, get down!" And we fell flat. And of course, that salvo actually landed on top of us and or hit in some trees and what have you. And that's when Topper Brown and the others got wounded. I think we can be proud of the lads who did what they were told to do. They were told to march on, whatever happened, and they did.
How do you feel now in 1998 about having done national service?
Again, I enjoyed it. I didn't mind it at all. But I had a good time, really. I mean, I was lucky. I wasn't stuck on Salisbury Plain, you know, there's a fella down the road from here, and his brother, this chap happened to say to him, "Hey, Don was in Korea, you know." He said, "Korea? I was in the camp from hell on Salisbury Plain." And Beryl looked at me, and we were about to smile, and we realised he was serious. He said, I've heard about your Korean club. He said, "I ought to be in that. I was sending supplies to Korea." We got up at started at 8 o'clock in the morning, worked till 5 o'clock at night, went back to a Nissan hut with only one little fire in it. He said it was the camp from hell. And he was absolutely serious. I guess it really depends which particular area you were, whether you what you think about national service. I think it's a thing, or it has been a thing, to say how everybody hated it and didn't cooperate, and only the regular soldiers were doing their duty, etc., etc., etc. And it's quite untrue. I mean, we were 54%, according to this is the commanding officer's figure, 54% national service. You must remember that's the teeth you're talking about, that 54%, because all the senior NCOs and officers, what have you, and rear echelons and all the other people that you have to take out before you actually get anybody up there to fight were all the regular soldiers. And it's a little bit of a sad reflection that some of the corporals, regular corporals, didn't do quite as well as you might have hoped. And I sort of put that down to the fact that this was just another war for them, and you know there were going to be lots more. Whilst for us, the national servicemen, it was their only war. They hadn't had one before, except of course living through the bombing and you know 6 years of war and what have you. But this was their only war, and that's perhaps why we remember it so well. Whilst they went on to got back to the, as soon as they could, a lot of them got back to the battalion. And in fact, when we came back from Hong Kong, when we got off the train at Fan Ling station, literally half the original battalion was there waiting for us. And the opening words, I remember quite clearly, that the chap whose section I'd taken over, and obviously after, what, 8 months of commanding this section, I thought of it as mine. And he said to me, "Oh, thanks very much for looking after my section for whilst you've, since I've been wounded." He said, "Thanks very much." He said, "Because I'll be taking it over again now." And that's literally, these are all good lessons in life, really. I mean, it says to you, no, you think you're an important sort of chap, but you're not. You're just another little cog in the wheel. And that's how it went on, gradually coming back. And I came back eventually to go to work. And I'm the boy again, you know, one of the lower lifes. And you've got to start fighting your way back up again from that. Good lessons, good lessons. Otherwise you get so cocky and think that you're so important that it gets out of hand. In fact, when I came home, I was very difficult to live with for a while. And then my old dad gave me a good talking to. And my mum had a cry. I think I had a cry as well together. And that was it. It was finished. All was over then. You don't need all this wretched counselling that they get up to today. And every time somebody gets hurt, or well, you know, got this stupid thing, haven't we, where the doctor's pricked herself and got £500,000. There's none of that. Just a bit of common sense is all it needed. Good telling off from Dad for being rude to me mum. Poor old mum had a good old cry. And then she decided to at last have a look at me hand, which she did. And she said, "Oh, well, that's you need a pension for this, disability pension." I couldn't believe it. And I said, "Well, no, it's just a little scratch. You don't have disability pensions for bent fingers and, you know, little holes and things like that." With all the people I'd seen with, certainly with, who needed disabilities. Anyway, she got down to it and wrote off. I wouldn't write off. I mean, I've been so embarrassed to do so. But she said everything going, and I just sort of signed my name on the end of the paper. And I had to go to Kingston to have a medical, and I was ever so embarrassed, because there were all these guys saying one arm, one leg, and all the rest of it, you know. And I said to one of the chaps with one leg, "What are you doing here then?" Because, you know, he'd been getting a pension since the Second War. He reminds me, he said, "Oh, they think my leg will grow back one day, so I have to come every so often." Apparently you had to go and be examined. And the funny thing was, the waterworks business, I'd had a wee before I went in, because I didn't want to be caught in there. And of course, that's what they wanted, a bottle of water. I couldn't go. And there, in the end, I had me trying to wee into a bottle, and there's two ex-soldiers, they were really, but civilians now, turning the tap on and off, trying to get me to wee. And I said, "Well, look, what the devil do you want this for? Because, you know, it's me hand I'm here for, not me waterworks." They said, "Well, we have to do it." And I said, "Oh, well, can't get it going." In the end, they let it go. I couldn't squeeze a dribble out, and I never did. I only had to go once. And I got a pension for £50. £25 as a lump sum, and £25 at half a crown a week. And, well, I mean, it wasn't all that much. Half a crown a week wasn't that much. So I used to let it mount up for once a month and get a pound. And that upset the, I used to go to Teddington post office, main post office, and collect it. That upset the chap behind the counter, who said, "This is a pension, and, you know, if you don't need it, don't have it," sort of thing, you know, "and don't leave it for a month, otherwise they'll stop it and what have you." And I thought, "Oh, blow that," because I was working away at the time, actually, as it happened, and you know, I didn't really have much time to get it. But that was a one-off. I had to sign to say that was a one-off. £25 lump, £25, half a crown a week for a bent finger.
What do you mean you were difficult to live with when you came back? What effect had the war had on your mood or behaviour?
I was. I could row or I was rude to my mother, really. I mean, that, in the home I'm talking about now, you know, I was ever so rude. I was rude to everybody, I think, you know. I could only talk to, I didn't seem as if I could talk to anybody who wasn't a veteran of any war. I mean, I could talk to veterans, mainly I talked to veterans of the First War, and veterans maybe some lesser of the Second War, or Korean veterans, but I couldn't seem to talk to anybody else for a while. This is only in the first couple of months, because, I mean, obviously my dad, he obviously wasn't going to put up with that, and as I say, he gave me a good severe talking to, and that was it. I was okay. I realised I was being an absolute pig, and I'd like to think I controlled it, I guess, because he never had occasion to speak to me about it again.
But why could you not speak to the others who had not been veterans?
I don't know. I don't know. I really don't know. I didn't want to talk about it. I could talk about it to Korean veterans, and I didn't want to talk about it at all. I never wanted to talk about it at all. I guess I did, maybe, occasionally, but I didn't want to talk about it. And it wasn't, in fact, until 1980 when I'd interviewed, incidentally, lots of First World War people during that period and got their stories. And in 1980, for some reason, I thought, so I wonder what... I began to see similarities between 1914, you know, and the Marne, and the advance and to Mons and withdrawal, you know, back to wherever, and down to near Soissons. I began to see similarities in that between the advance north that we did once we broke out of the Pusan perimeter and up to, well, from our point of view, within about 50 miles of the Yalu River, and the rapid withdrawal again after. I could see similarities in the movements. And I also saw, if you reversed things, there was a similarity with the way the Chinese were attacking, and if with us defending on a you know, reversed things where they were us and we were the Germans, for example, you know, and they were doing fairly movements fairly similar to what the British armies had done in 1914. I began to take a casual interest in it. And I looked around, there was no information. The books that had been had all gone out of print. There was nothing going at all, and nobody was interested. And I looked around to see if anybody had written anything on the Middlesex, and found that John Shipster had put together the notes from the journal, which I had in actual fact. And I eventually got it had gone out of print, but I eventually got a copy with all the rest of the... there had been a little bit of difficulty between him and Colonel Mann, and an interchange of letters and things like that. And I realised that he'd made, in his editorial work, he'd made a lot of errors, quite serious errors, to be quite honest. The notes were first class. The editorial, which he'd only done in about 10 weeks, a marvellous effort. I mean, I couldn't have ever done it in that time. It's taken me 20 years to get as far as I have. But he put a few, shall we say, thoughts in that were not quite correct. And in a sense, for me, it spoiled it for me, because I was interested in accuracy. And Austin Reed, he reprinted it. And I did ask him if maybe they put in some notes to say, you know, to correct these things which are... The Roll of Honour was wrong, and there was also, I've got a whole list of errors in it. But of course, he didn't feel, and quite rightly so, he was reprinting a book that had been put out about 10 or 20 years ago, before this time, before 1980, and he didn't feel he could alter it. And he was quite right, because he couldn't without John Shipps' permission. So it came out again, a reprint of the original. Which, incidentally, the photograph on the front, which is of an MMG, is in fact an Australian MMG, and there's a little story attached to that, because it's actually firing over the top of my section position. And the photographer had come along. This was at just as we were withdrawing south from Chae San, Yong something or other, and a photographer come up to photograph. He wanted an all-Australian scene, and we were on an orders group, in actual fact, because it was a pretty delicate situation at the time. And when we came back, the LMG team were standing with all their equipment hanging about them, up behind the photographer and the this Australian and MMG, and they kicked all the stuff in the trench back into it because he didn't want anything showing, and he was taking these photographs. And of course Major Allen had come back to inspect the booth. He wasn't particularly pleased about this, so he sent the old photographer on his way a bit sharply, charged the two guys for dereliction of duty, charged the duty NCO for allowing it to happen. And these two poor lads who were there, if they'd been in the photograph, it would have made a better photograph, I think, but they got charged. I mean, I was okay because I wasn't there. I was at the orders group, and they weren't my lads. In actual fact, I know the two lads who they were. The names of the two lads, and I also know the name of.